A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's a bit different. He's asking Herman to take us on a tour through the history of Mansfield, Connecticut. Not the dry textbook version, but the colorful side. The early settlement, the silk industry that put the town on the map in the 19th century, the eccentric characters, and how stores went from a crossroads to the dominant population center once the store's agricultural school took root. And he specifically asked Herman to weave in his own anecdotes, since he grew up there. Spent half his youth at Horse Barn Hill watching cows and sunsets, the other half at the Yukon Dairy Bar, where he worked summers until one fateful day he was inexplicably fired. The reason, apparently, was never made clear. He has theories.
I have theories, some of them even plausible.
Where do we even start with this? Your hometown, silkworms, land grants, and a firing that still haunts you. By the way, today's episode is powered by DeepSeek V4 Pro, writing our script.
Keeping us honest. All right, let's start with what Mansfield actually is, because even people in Connecticut sometimes get fuzzy on this. Mansfield is a town in Tolan County, eastern Connecticut. It's about 30 miles east of Hartford. And the thing to understand is that Mansfield, the town, and Storrs, the place, are not the same thing. Storrs is a village within Mansfield. It's not even incorporated separately. For most of Mansfield's history, Storrs was basically nothing. Farmland, some crossroads, a church. The population center was Mansfield Center, which is a few miles south. That's where the action was.
Storrs is the upstart, the university annex that ate the town.
And it happened because of two brothers named Charles and Augustus Storrs. In 1881, they donated 170 acres of land and some old buildings to the state for an agricultural school, the Storrs Agricultural School. That was the seed. It became Connecticut Agricultural College, then Connecticut State College, and finally the University of Connecticut in 1939. But here's the thing most people don't realize. Charles and Augustus were not farmers. They were businessmen. They made their money in the silk industry.
Which is the thread that runs through the whole early story.
It really is. Mansfield was part of a wave of silk production in New England that a lot of people have never heard of. Everyone knows about the textile mills, cotton, wool, but silk? It was a genuine industry. The key figure is a guy named William Fisk. In the 1830s, Fisk was experimenting with mulberry trees and silkworms in Mansfield. Mulberry leaves are what silkworms eat. He figured out that the climate in eastern Connecticut could actually support sericulture. And he wasn't just a hobbyist, he built a silk mill in Mansfield, one of the earliest in the United States. This was before the big industrial mills in Paterson, New Jersey. Mansfield was on the cutting edge.
I have to ask, how does a sleepy farming town become the locus of the American silk industry? It seems so unlikely.
Part of it was the mulberry craze. In the 1830s, there was a speculative bubble around mulberry trees. People thought silk was going to be the next big American industry, and you needed mulberry trees to feed the worms. Prices for mulberry saplings went through the roof. Farmers all over the Northeast planted them. Most of it collapsed. Classic bubble. But Mansfield actually had the right conditions and some people who knew what they were doing. William Fisk and his family stuck with it after the speculation died down. They built real expertise. By the mid-19th century, the Fisk Mill was producing silk thread and fabric that was sold in Boston and New York. Mansfield silk had a reputation.
The Storrs brothers got rich off this.
Charles and Augustus Storrs were silk manufacturers. They had a mill in the Gurleyville section of Mansfield. They were successful enough that by the 1880s they could afford to donate land and buildings worth about $5,000 to the state for an agricultural school. That $5,000 donation is the reason Yukon exists. And here's the twist. The Storrs brothers thought the school should teach practical farming. They wanted it to help local farmers modernize. I don't think they ever imagined it would become a massive research university with 30,000 students.
What was Mansfield like before the university swallowed it? Let's talk about the early settlement.
Mansfield was settled in the late 1600s, part of the wave of English colonists moving into eastern Connecticut. It was originally part of the town of Windham. Mansfield split off and was incorporated as its own town in 1702. The early economy was almost entirely agricultural. Dairy farming, some orchards, corn, hay. The soil in eastern Connecticut is rocky. It's not the lush farmland of the Midwest. These were tough, self-sufficient farms. The kind of place where a family might clear a few acres of forest, build a stone wall with the rocks they pulled out of the field, and just keep going.
Stone walls everywhere.
You drive through Mansfield today, and you see stone walls running through what are now dense woods. Those walls mark where the forest was cleared for pasture 200 years ago. When the farms were abandoned, the forest grew back. The walls stayed. It's a landscape of ghosts.
That's actually haunting. So you've got this agricultural town, and then the silk industry arrives. What were the other industries?
Grist mills, sawmills, a button factory in Eagleville, some small-scale manufacturing along the Willimantic River and the Fenton River. But nothing at the scale of the big industrial cities. Mansfield stayed rural. The population in 1800 was about 2,000 people. By 1900, it was still only about 3,000. It was a quiet place, the kind of town where everybody knew everybody.
Then the agricultural school arrives. What was the early campus like?
The first class in 1881 had something like 13 students. The curriculum was basic: how to test soil, how to rotate crops, animal husbandry. The first building was a converted orphanage that the Storrs brothers had acquired. That building, Old Whitney Hall, burned down years ago, but that was the original campus. For decades, the school was small. Even by 1900, enrollment was only a few hundred. It was basically a trade school with a farm attached.
Now let's talk about Horse Barn Hill, because this is where your personal history starts to weave in. Daniel specifically mentioned you spent half your youth there.
Horse Barn Hill is the heart of the campus for me. It's this big open hill on the north side of Yukon overlooking the campus and the surrounding hills. The university keeps dairy cows there. It's still a working dairy, part of the College of Agriculture. When I was growing up in Storrs in the 70s and 80s, Horse Barn Hill was where you went to watch the sunset. You'd sit on the grass, the cows would be grazing nearby, and you could see for miles. In the fall, the leaves turning. In the winter, sledding down the hill. It was this perfect, unspoiled piece of the old Mansfield.
Did you actually interact with the cows? Or was this more of a contemplative distance thing?
Oh, I interacted. I knew some of those cows. There was one Holstein named Gertrude who was particularly friendly. Would walk right up to the fence and let you scratch her forehead. I spent hours up there. It sounds idyllic, and it was. But it was also, how do I put this? It was the place where you could feel the tension between the old Mansfield and the new. The hill is this pastoral relic, but right behind it are the dormitories and the science buildings and the football stadium. The cows are surrounded by the university that grew up around them.
The Dairy Bar. You worked there.
The Yukon Dairy Bar. It's an institution. It's been there since the 1950s, serving ice cream made from the milk produced by the university's own herd. The cows on Horse Barn Hill, the milk goes to the Dairy Bar. It's this perfect closed loop. The ice cream is genuinely excellent. They make it in small batches. The flavors rotate. The Dairy Bar is this little building on Route 195, right at the edge of campus. When I was a teenager, it was the best summer job in town.
You got fired. You got fired.
I got fired. It was the summer of 1983. I was 17 years old. I'd been working there for 2 summers already, scooping ice cream, working the counter, cleaning up. I was a good employee. I showed up on time. I didn't steal. I was friendly to customers. And then one day in August, the manager calls me into the back room and tells me it's my last shift. Just, we're letting you go.
You never got a reason?
He said it wasn't necessary to go into details. I was stunned. I walked home that day just completely bewildered. I replayed every interaction I'd had for the previous 2 weeks. Did I offend someone? Did I mess up an order? Was there a complaint? Nothing made sense.
You said you have theories.
I have 3 theories. Theory 1, there was a disagreement about the proper ratio of hot fudge to ice cream in a sundae. I had strong opinions. I still do. Some might say I was inflexible.
You got fired over hot fudge doctrine.
It's possible. Theory 2, the manager's nephew needed a summer job and there weren't enough shifts to go around. I was the expendable one. Theory 3, and this is the one I think about late at night, there was an incident involving a goat. there was a petting zoo event on campus. I may have, on my break, let a goat into the dairy bar. The goat did not consume any ice cream, but there were witnesses.
You brought a goat into a food service establishment, and you're puzzled about why you were fired.
I didn't say I was puzzled. I said the reason was never made clear. There's a difference, and the goat was very well behaved.
I'm going to file this under. Herman's life is a series of inexplicable animal incidents. There was the wedding goat incident, too.
That was completely different. That goat was uninvited. But let's get back to Mansfield. Because the story of how stores became the population center is really the story of the university's growth, and that growth accelerated dramatically after World War II. Bill transformed American higher education. UConn saw a massive influx of veterans. Enrollment jumped from about 2,000 before the war to over 10,000 by the 1960s. The state poured money into new buildings, new dorms, new academic programs. The old agricultural school was becoming a comprehensive university, and as the university grew, stores grew with it. Housing developments went up. Businesses opened to serve the students and faculty. The old farms were sold off and subdivided.
What was lost?
That's the question, isn't it? A lot of the old Mansfield families sold their land. Some of them had been farming the same acres for 200 years. The open fields became parking lots and dormitories. The population shifted from farmers and mill workers to students and professors. The town's identity changed. Mansfield Center, which had been the heart of the town, became secondary. Stores became the center of gravity.
Was there resistance? Did people fight the expansion?
Town-gown tension is a long tradition. In the 1970s and 80s, there were battles over zoning, over student housing, over the university's tax-exempt status. UConn doesn't pay property taxes on its academic buildings, which means the town loses that revenue. But the university also brings jobs and economic activity. It's a complicated relationship. Some longtime residents resented the transformation. But you can't stop growth like that. The university became the largest employer in the region. Mansfield's fate was tied to UConn's.
Let's talk about some of the eccentric characters. Daniel mentioned those. Who stands out?
There was William Fisk himself, who I mentioned. He was a genuine visionary, but also apparently quite odd. He kept meticulous records of his silkworm experiments, temperature, humidity, feeding schedules, and he wrote long letters to agricultural journals defending the silk industry against skeptics. He was obsessed. The kind of person who would invite you over to see his mulberry grove and then talk for 3 hours about cocoon yields.
He was the 18th century version of you with a different specialty.
I'll take that as a compliment. There was also a character named Orrin Holt, who was a Mansfield native who became a U congressman in the 1830s. He was a Jacksonian Democrat, very colorful, known for his fiery speeches. After his political career ended, he came back to Mansfield and became something of a local sage. People would seek him out for advice.
Anyone more recent?
In the 20th century, there was a professor at UConn named Albert E. He was an economist, but his real passion was ice cream. He invented the UConn Dairy Bar's formula for making ice cream. He literally wrote the book on it. And he was known to show up at the Dairy Bar unannounced to test batches. If the texture wasn't right, he'd march into the back and start adjusting the machines. The man took ice cream very seriously.
That explains the culture you walked into. The hot fudge doctrine wasn't just you. It was institutional.
Waugh set the standard. And I upheld it. Possibly too vigorously, but the principle was sound.
What about the landscape itself? You mentioned the stone walls. What else shaped the physical character of the town?
The Willimantic River forms the western boundary of Mansfield. The Fenton River runs through the eastern part of town. In the 19th century, those rivers powered mills. There were mill villages, Gurleyville, Eagleville, Merrow, each with its own little cluster of houses and a mill building. Those villages still exist, but they're mostly residential now. The mills are gone or converted to other uses. It's a landscape of layers. You can read the history in the buildings and the roads.
The old roads. The stagecoach routes.
Route 44 and Route 195 were originally turnpikes. The Boston Turnpike ran through Mansfield in the early 1800s. Stagecoaches stopped at the taverns in Mansfield Center. There was a famous tavern called the Mansfield House that hosted travelers for decades. That building is gone now, but the road network still follows those old routes. The bones of the town haven't changed that much. What's changed is what's built on them.
You grew up surrounded by all this history. Did you appreciate it at the time?
When you're a kid, the stone walls are just there. The old mill buildings are just old buildings. It's only later, when you've moved away and come back, that you start to see the layers. I remember walking through the woods behind our house and finding an old foundation, just a rectangle of stones in the middle of the forest. Someone lived there. Someone cleared that land and built a house and probably raised a family. And now it's just stones in the woods. That stuck with me.
The ghosts again.
Mansfield is full of them. And I don't mean that in a spooky way. I mean the physical traces of lives lived. The stone walls, the cellar holes, the old cemeteries with headstones from the 1700s. The past isn't very, very deep there. You just have to look.
Let's talk about the university today. UConn has become this massive institution. What would Charles and Augustus Storrs think if they saw it?
I think they'd be astonished. And maybe a little conflicted. They wanted to help local farmers, and UConn still does that through the College of Agriculture and the Extension Service. But the university is now a research powerhouse. It's got a medical school, a law school, a massive engineering program. It competes nationally for faculty and research dollars. The student body is diverse, drawn from all over the country and the world. The little agricultural school with 13 students has become a small city.
The town of Mansfield has been fundamentally reshaped.
The population of Mansfield is now over 25,000, and the vast majority of that is connected to the university, students, faculty, staff. The old farming families are a small minority. The dairy farms that once defined the landscape are mostly gone, except for the university's own herd. Mansfield Center still has its historic district, with beautiful old houses and a white steepled church, but it's a quiet residential area now, not the commercial hub it once was.
What was gained?
Economic vitality, for one thing. The university brings hundreds of millions of dollars into the local economy. The town has a world-class library, museums, performances, lectures. None of that would exist without UConn. And there's a certain energy that comes with being a college town. The rhythms of the academic year shape daily life. The town is never boring.
You miss the old Mansfield?
I miss pieces of it. I miss the Mansfield I knew as a kid, which was already a version of the town in transition. But I also recognize that towns change. They always have. The Mansfield of 1800 wasn't the same as the Mansfield of 1700. The silk mills changed it. The railroad changed it. The university changed it. The question isn't whether change happens, it's what you preserve and what you let go.
That's surprisingly philosophical for someone who once brought a goat into an ice cream shop.
I contain multitudes.
Tell me more about Horse Barn Hill. You mentioned it's still a working dairy. Is it still the same place you remember?
The hill itself hasn't changed much. The view is still spectacular. The cows are still there. But the context around it has changed. When I was a kid, Horse Barn Hill felt remote. It was at the edge of campus. Now the campus has expanded past it. There are new buildings on the other side of the hill. It's still beautiful, but it feels more like a preserved island than part of a continuous rural landscape, which I suppose is what it is. The university consciously maintains it as open space. It's a deliberate choice.
The dairy bar is still there?
Still serving the same ice cream. The building's been renovated a few times, but the spirit is intact. I still go there when I visit. I order the same thing I always ordered, a scoop of chocolate chip cookie dough in a waffle cone. And every time I'm there, I look at the counter and think about the summer of 83.
Do you still know anyone who works there?
The turnover is high. It's mostly students now, but the ice cream is just as good. Albert Waugh's formula lives on.
You mentioned the silk industry put Mansfield on the map. What happened to it? Why did it decline?
The American silk industry as a whole declined in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Cheaper imports from Japan and China undercut domestic production. The tariffs that had protected American silk manufacturers were reduced. And then synthetic fibers like rayon and nylon arrived and changed the textile industry entirely. The mills in Mansfield closed or converted to other uses. By the 1920s, the silk industry was basically gone from eastern Connecticut. The mulberry trees were cut down or left to go wild. The expertise that William Fisk and the Storrs brothers had built up just evaporated.
The industry that created the wealth that founded the university disappeared, but the university remained.
That's the irony. The silk industry is a footnote now, but the university it helped create has become one of the most important institutions in the state, Charles and Augustus Storrs probably thought the agricultural school would be their legacy. I don't think they imagined it would be the thing that outlasted everything else they built.
What do you think Mansfield will look like in 50 years?
That's hard to say. Universities are facing demographic headwinds, fewer high school graduates, questions about cost and value. UConn will have to adapt. But Mansfield has survived a lot of changes. The farms gave way to silk mills. The silk mills gave way to the university. Something will come next. The town has a way of reinventing itself.
Or maybe it'll just keep being a college town, and the university will keep growing, and the stone walls will still be there in the woods.
The stone walls will definitely still be there. Those things are indestructible. And the cows on Horse Barn Hill. I hope those are still there, too. There's something grounding about cows in the middle of a university campus. It reminds you where all this started.
On that note, I think we should address your firing one more time. You've had 40-plus years to think about this. If you could go back and confront that manager, what would you say?
I'd ask him one question. Was it the goat or was it the hot fudge? I just want to know. The not knowing is what eats at me.
It might have been neither. Maybe you were just annoying.
That's theory four, and I reject it.
All right, let's wrap this up with some forward-looking thoughts. And then we've got Hilbert's daily fun fact.
Here's what I'd leave listeners with. Mansfield is a small town in eastern Connecticut that most people have never heard of, but its story is the story of America in miniature, the early settlers clearing the land, the speculative bubble around mulberry trees, the rise and fall of an industry, the transformation brought by a public university, the tension between preservation and growth. All of that is there, in one town if you know where to look. And if you're ever in eastern Connecticut, stop at the UConn Dairy Bar. Get a waffle cone. Walk up to Horse Barn Hill at sunset. You'll see what I mean.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The Sao Tome giant tree frog, endemic to the island of Sao Tome, can reach a snout-to-vent length of 110 millimeters, roughly the length of a standard modern smartphone, which would have been an utterly meaningless comparison to anyone alive in the 1720s.
Right.
That's going to stick with me. This has been My Weird Prompts. You can find every episode at myweirdprompts.com. We'll be back soon with another one.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. Time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.